Okay, some of my recent work has been already reported by my collaborators in this conference. So I'd like to report something I've been thinking together with the people local here, the Gautam Mandal and Spenta Wadia. And the work is in progress, and hopefully this will be posted on the net within a week or so. And it's about the classical and planar limit of non-commutative vacuum and solitons. And the emergent theme in recent years, for several years we have been pursuing, is trying to identify the solvable, understandable limit of string theories and M theories. And in quite recently, the two directions of common theme has appeared. One is the open string in B mu nu background, the two-form background, and the other one is tachyon condensation. And they are basically the external field problem, and those two problems are not unrelated with each other, and in fact has given many new insight, which has been reported, you know, in this conference as well. And therefore, the starting setup of understanding both issue might be something like non-commutative field theory as a low energy limit of either cases or both cases. So the order, which might be tall or short, is whether we can understand better this non-commutative field theory as a way of understanding string and M theory, especially is the vacuum as well as the spectrum, such as solitons and low energy excitations. And the starting setup has been already studied quite extensively, initiated by Gopal Kumar and Minwala and Strominger. And however, some of the issues, especially the quantum aspect of the non-commutative field theory, has not been yet addressed. So that's something I'd like to discuss in this talk. And especially, I'd like to raise the question of systematic understanding non-commutative vacuum as well as non-commutative solitons. So as a way of thinking, I'd like to propose is that the large non-commutativity limit of non-commutative field theory, indeed mentioned, might be viewed as D minus two-dimensional matrix model in the large N limit. And this idea actually is basically reincarnation of twist Eguchi Kawai model, which has been already mentioned in several talks today. And some of the findings, and I propose this as a way of thinking, and whether one can also pursue this direction to get some concrete calculation result is something yet to be seen. So some of the findings by using the already known result in matrix model is that the quantum deformation of such soliton generically arises as soon as quantum effects are taken into account. And second is that the GMS soliton, which is the classical solution of non-commutative field theory, can be understood in a systematic way starting from quantum soliton. And another one is that generically, the translational symmetry along the non-commutativity space is dynamically broken by quantum corrections. And this would be an interesting novel mechanism of inducing Higgs mechanism in non-commutative gauge theory. So these four small issues is the one I'd like to spell out qualitatively. So let's just recollect ourselves about the large N matrix model. In the large N limit, for example, the following matrix integral, where V of M is some generic polynomial of Hermitian N by N matrix, can be rewritten in the saddle point limit, large N limit, as a free energy of this type, where the procedure is, just to remind yourself, just diagonalize Hermitian matrix into angular part and diagonal elements, and diagonal entries can be evaluated by saddle point of the free energy, and in due course of that integration of angular variable, we end up with non-trivial Jacobian, which give rise to the repercussion of eigenvalues, and that's the second term. Now, in terms of this eigenvalue density, which I denoted as rho of lambda, this free energy contains two terms, and the competition between the two terms is what determines the saddle point of this matrix integral. Now, depending on this, the coupling parameter beta in this integral as a function of the large N parameter, there are several possible saddle point scalings. The first one is in terms of Feynman diagram reinterpretation, is usual fixed order perturbation theory that corresponds to the inverse coupling constant beta being proportional to entry some fractional power or some power nu, where the power is larger than one. And second one is what is known as a planar limit, which is a resummation of the leading planar diagrams. That's when beta is proportional to n linearly. And third one, which is pathological limit, which probably cannot be reached by planar limit because of some possible phase transition, is that if the beta is scaling to the n by some fraction of power less than unity. In this case, it corresponds to strong coupling. So I won't really discuss the third cases, but I'd like to pose the second case and first case and making an intimate connection with non-commutative field theory. So let's make some specific comparison. So let's start with two-dimensional Euclidean non-commutative field theory. So the starting action is just the one single scalar field phi whose potential Vu of phi is generic polynomial in phi, and star is the usual Moyard star product. And I would like to define this field theory on a non-commutative plane whose coordinate, Euclidean coordinate y1, y2 do not commute, and non-commutativity is given by theta. Now let's take the largest theta limit, and this has been already spelled out by Gopakuma, Minwala, and Strominger, and it is convenient for later counting to rescale the coordinate y by 1 over square root of theta. Then in terms of dimensionless coordinate x, the action can be rewritten in the middle form, and as can be seen, the action has manifest dependence on theta, which can be reinterpreted as coupling inverse coupling constant in this limit, and second term is oppressed by 1 over theta compared to the first term. Now the second term, the suppression of the second term is something interesting, which I'll mention immediately now, but already mentioned by several authors in today's talk, this field theory in this large theta limit, it can be also rewritten in terms of operator languages through so-called Weil-Moyer map. And in this Weil-Moyer map, what we are introducing is one particle Hilbert space, which carries the representation of this Heisenberg algebra. And in terms of that, Moyer field, the non-commutative field phi of x can be rephrased in terms of the operator acting on the Hilbert space. And the two-dimensional integral in non-commutative plane can be rephrased in terms of trace over that Hilbert space. Then in terms of these Weil operator languages, this action in large theta limit can be expressed in terms of the trace over the Hilbert space, over potential operator as well as subleading operators. Now therefore, in the large infinite theta limit, the first term will be dominant, and therefore the classical solution just corresponds to critical point of the potential, and the solution that has been found by Gopakuma, Minwala, and Strominger corresponds to, very generically, just diagonal sum in appropriate basis, just diagonal sum of the critical values of that potential. Now here, Pi is the one-dimensional projection operator, and therefore, in that Hilbert space, if I sum over all the one-dimensional Hilbert space, the projection operator, then it should correspond to unit operator. Now at infinite theta, the leading term, which corresponds to only the non-derivative potential term of the action, enjoys the accidental symmetry, which is U infinity. And under that U infinity transformation, phi operator goes into adjoint rotations by the U infinity symmetry. Now, one of the solutions in this classical solution corresponds to vacuum solution in case the potential is stable minimum. And now vacuum solution is the case where all the diagonal eigenvalues of this phi operator is equal to lambda bar, which is the point, critical point of the stable vacuum. Therefore, in that case, phi operator itself corresponds to proportional to identity operator. If I rephrase that in terms of original two-dimensional Euclidean non-commutative field phi, that corresponds to constant value, which is independent space, Euclidean space. Now the other solution, which has at least two different values of diagonal eigenvalues, corresponds to GMS soliton, this classical solution. And the simple example is for the case of this double well, having n1 eigenvalues in one minimum and another eigenvalues in n2 projection operator space. And this can be, in the language of the matrix model, can be rephrased in terms of eigenvalue density. And here I have this restricted total Hilbert space to be dimension n. And the eigenvalue density is given by this one. So n1 over the n for lambda equal minus 1 and n2 over n for lambda equals 1. So the eigenvalue density corresponds to spike delta functions. Now, so far, all the solution corresponds to classical one. Now, one can ask, what about the quantum aspect? To do the quantum mechanics, we have to consider all the functional integral over all field configurations, phi, and in the language of operators, that corresponds to integration over operator phi hat. Okay, so this is something we have to do, at least in the larger theta limit. Now, let us recollect some known aspect about zero-dimensional matrix model. So this setup is, again, essentially the same as the earlier transparency. Now, by minimizing this large and free energy, the n equal infinity saddle point is straightforwardly calculated for the case of double well. And the eigenvalue density distribution is given by this function. Now, here, beta bar is inverse coupling constant, which is fixed in the planar limit, which is effectively the inverse of a toothed coupling parameter. Now, as you can see from the eigenvalue density distribution, in the limit beta bar going to infinity, you'll see that this eigenvalue distribution becomes narrower and its amplitude, its height becomes arbitrarily large such that the integration of the eigenvalue densities of two wells sums up to a unity. So therefore, in the large beta bar limit, we begin to see that two delta functions emerge precisely at the location of the degenerate minimum of this double well potential. So you know, utilizing this aspect, now we can deduce some quartet feature of quantum solitons in the two-dimensional Euclidean non-quantum field theory, namely the large theta limit. We just start with this leading order path integral, and we basically take advantage of this matrix model result. However, one has to be a little bit cautious at this stage, because in the casual definition of the non-commutative plane is such that its Heisenberg algebra has infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So this is not like usual matrix model in the sense that here n, the analog of n in the matrix model is strictly infinite rather than taking the limit going to infinity. However, even though at classical level there's no real need to do so, you know, at quantum level, there is every good reason we have to introduce both UV and IR cutoff. And UV is obvious because the theory does not really cure any UV divergence. And IR cutoff is also necessary. And one perturbative or diagrammatic way of understanding that is basically UV-IR mixing of Seiberg et al. And another way of thinking of that is that basically rephrasing non-commutative field theory in terms of twisted Eguchi Kawai model. And they are starting from the lattice definition and also the finite n limit. And taking large n limit basically corresponds to having both UV and IR cutoff. And more mathematical definition of this non-commutative, regularized non-commutative space is given by Liffel, and that's essentially, in physics terminology, corresponds to twisted Eguchi Kawai model. So the limit we would like to think of is that first we regularize infrared such that dimension of Hilbert space, h theta, is finite. And also we consider large theta limit such that the ratio of that is fixed. So this we view as inverse, a toothed coupling constant in the corresponding matrix model. Then we'd like to understand the quantum version of GMS soliton, and we'd like to understand what the classical limit of that corresponds to. So here's a look. So from the previous transparency, I have given the eigenvalue distribution for the zero-dimensional matrix model, which I can view as this planar limit of non-commutative field theory. There, the eigenvalue distribution starts from this green one for generic value of the effective inverse toothed coupling constant beta bar. But as beta bar goes to infinity, which corresponds to taking the limit from planar to fixed order perturbation theory, the eigenvalue distribution becomes narrow and spikes up and reduces to delta functions. That's precisely the classical GMS soliton configuration I alluded earlier. So in this way, we can recover the GMS classical soliton, and on the way, we understand at least some qualitative feature about the eigenvalue distribution, and therefore, up to U infinity unitary rotation, we can find an explicit form of quantum solitons, and it's unimaginable that soliton itself has a deformed size. Now, by now, one might have been suspicious a little bit about all these jugglings, because after all, if I look at the functional integral definition of two-dimensional Euclidean non-commutative field theory, the functional integral is nothing special, because the functional integral measure, which is defined by the norm or in the field configuration space in this way, does not really see the star product. This is quadratic in field, and it's integrated over the non-commutative plane, so therefore this star product in between is superfluous. Therefore, the measure of non-commutative field theory is essentially the same as the commutative case. So where would this van der Monde non-trivial van der Monde Jacobian arise? On the way, understanding this non-commutative field theory in the large theta limit, the way of thinking about it is, again, from the Weil-Moyer map. If you start with some convenient basis, which turned out to be, in this case, in some sort of plane wave basis, where two non-commutative coordinate x1, x2 as an operator in Hilbert space carries a representation of conjugate with each other, P and Q, then after a straightforward calculation, one easily finds that the diagonal element, the counterpart of diagonal, the entries in corresponding Weil operator formulation corresponds to this field phi of x taking a function, being a function of only one coordinate, for example, x2. And then arbitrary other field configuration would be related by it by unitary rotation, which of course is a function of two coordinates, x1 and x2. Therefore, I can visualize this is one of the coordinate in non-commutative plane, let's say x2, as the index of eigenvalues along diagonal directions, and the other one, x1, as the off-diagonal one. So this is some schematic viewpoint of that. Then one can do the change of variable systematically starting from this form of the non-commutative field. And on the way, we pick up the Jacobian. And Jacobian is written in this form. Here, Jacobian is a function of the only diagonal entries, exactly like in matrix model case. And the diagonal field phi d depends on x2 coordinate as well as p. And here p, remember, it was this operator, the eigenvalue operator that corresponds to x1, namely x1 is off-diagonal ones. So this is precisely the counterpart of van der Monde determinant. And in this derivation, one has to use successively the Moyer star representation, but that's just standard one. So at the end of the day, we can in fact paraphrase two-dimensional non-commutative field theory in terms of effective one-dimensional collective field theory, all written in terms of this diagonal field phi of d. So the first term is leading term, and the second one is log of this van der Monde determinant term. Now here, in the case of the potential is order of unity, as well as the log of the eigenvalue difference is order of unity, we'd like to compare the weight of the first, the two terms. And the first one is basically theta non-commutative times, the volume of x1 direction and volume of x2. This already suggests that we have to regularize the volume of the non-commutative space. Otherwise, the entire expression does not really make sense. And the second term is proportional to the volume of p variable, which is eigenvalue of x1 operator, and the volume of x2 directions. So now, if these two parameters compete with each other of the same order, then we essentially get a planar limit. Indeed, it turned out to be the case that, for example, if you adopt the same definition as twist Iguchi-Kawai model, then it corresponds to the fact that to the limit that first coefficient theta Lx1 Lx2 is precisely the same order as the second one, L, the volume of the P variable and X2 variable. And from this one, we can deduce that at least in two-dimensional non-commutative plane, theta is precisely proportional to linear power in N. Therefore, this is a planar limit. Now, so far, we have introduced both the IR cutoff N as well as UV cutoff, lattice cutoff A. Now, in order to take the continuum limit as the final definition, we have to also scale A with respect to n, inappropriate power. If I choose this power minus nu to be precisely 1/2, then we end up with two-dimensional non-combinatorial, whereas if I take nu between 0 and 1/2, we end up with the infinitely large non-commutative plane. So we can continue this discussion for one higher dimensional case, 2 plus 1. Then undoubtedly, by repeating the same procedure, we end up with, in the largest theta limit, 0 plus 1-dimensional matrix quantum mechanics problem. And again, after diagonalization, in this case, we all also know very well that the von Neumann determinant effect is turning eigenvalues into the positions of the fictitious fermion, and the fermion dynamics is governed by this one-particle Hamiltonian, and m-particle Hamiltonian is the linear sum of that. Now, eigenvalue distribution is basically momentum integration of what is called the Wigner distribution function of that the fictitious fermion, and the solution in the large n limit can be found by a saddle point WKB approximation. And if I have potential V of X, and the eigenvalue distribution is essentially given by this one in the WKB approximation. So pictorial is of this type. And in the large n limit, n is infinity, this the integration constant, which corresponds to energy, one particle energy, can be chosen unequal for different well. So for example, two-cut solution of this type give rise to eigenvalue distribution of that type. And again, in the weak toothed coupling limit, beta bar going to zero, then we end up with a delta function-like distribution. And that, again, corresponds to precise the classical GMS soliton. Now, all this, based on all this qualitative result, what can we say about the quantum version of the soliton? The one thing is that, without any detailed calculations, is that this, we can say that the quantum correction to classical soliton mass is always positive. The reason is extremely simple. The mass of the soliton at leading order in theta, in one over theta expansion, is given by the potential integral over the eigenvalue distribution. And compared to this classical one, which is just denoted as a spike here, the quantum one is the one distributed by the Fermi statistics. So therefore, if I look at this integral for both classical and quantum cases, in the quantum limit, because eigenvalue repulsion, the energy contribution to potential is always larger than this minimum one, namely the classical one. Therefore, the quantum soliton mass is always larger than the classical one. And this is, in some sense, a little bit in contrast to the usual intuition based on second-order perturbations theory, which always gives negative contributions. Now, another aspect I'd like to bring up is, again, based on extremely simple observation, is that generically at quantum level, translational symmetry along the non-commutative plane is always broken. The reason is, again, extremely simple. At classical level, if I have this double well potential, for example, then this phi field will develop expectation value whose eigenvalues are all same and corresponds to minimum of that potential. And that, in the language of the original non-commutative field, by usual the Weyl-Boyer map, one easily find that that corresponds to exactly the constant value, namely the minimum value of the potential. However, in the planar limit, for example, named taking the quantum effect, what one finds is that this eigenvalue does not sit on exactly at the bottom, but they repel with each other and make a distribution. So therefore, the operator phi has an eigenvalue whose eigenvalues are all different and have a distribution of characteristic shape of this one. Now, given this one, one can go back and make Weyl-Moyer inverse map and try to figure out what the corresponding two-dimensional or higher-dimensional non-commutative field phi x corresponds to. Because it's no longer the same eigenvalue, therefore it cannot be identity operator. Therefore, it's a Fourier transform, it's not delta function. Therefore, this one is generically a very non-trivial function of x. Therefore, expectation value at quantum level in this planar limit is inhomogeneous. So therefore, upshot is that even though classically the spontaneous symmetry breaking in non-commutative field theory is like a usual commutative case. In the non-commutative field theory in the large theta limit and in the planar limit, for example, translational symmetry is always broken. And also because I have resummed all the planar diagram, this is self-consistent result. And and it should be very generic. Now, I'd like to make a remark. So far, I have ignored all this gradient term because it's 1 over theta. In fact, compared to the Van Diemen determinant part, which is order of n over theta, this one is further suppressed by 1 over n. Therefore, this is a sub-sub leading correction. Nevertheless, if one takes into account of this gradient term, what one finds is that among all possible inhomogeneous expectation value of scalar field, stride phase, which has the least derivative contribution of energy, is the one which is favored. So what to make out of this? I'd like to make one comment, which is that in case that I now couple the scalar field to the non-committed gauge field, there's a very interesting novel Higgs mechanism that can be triggered. Namely, as already mentioned in earlier talk this morning, in the non-commutative gauge theory, non-commutative gauge symmetry transformation can be visualized as part of the space translations along non-commutative plane. And simplicity of seeing that, for example, in adjoint representation field is that gauge transformation of that is related to that adjoint scalar field value at different positions. And clearly, in the limit, non-commutativity parameter theta goes to zero, the adjoint scalar field decouples from the gauge field. So this one is a very non-trivial effect of non-commutativity. And so once the translational symmetry is broken, then one would anticipate that gauge symmetry is also broken because gauge symmetry transformation corresponds to translation in space. Okay, I again emphasize that in the theta going to zero limit, adjoint scalar corresponds to neutral scalar, therefore does not couple to gauge field. And also in the commutative UN gauge theory, if you couple gauge field to adjoint scalar, then generically the symmetry breaking pattern is that it breaks into maximal Cartan, so U1 to the N. Now here, we have a very interesting one. Even though we have just U1 non-commutative gauge theory, as soon as I couple to adjoint representation scalar, because the scalar sector already breaks the translational symmetry at quantum level, even though classically the gauge symmetry is not broken at quantum level, the gauge symmetry is spontaneously broken. And because the symmetry breaking is varying in spatial directions, if one deduced the effective Lagrangian of a massive photon, non-commutative photon in this theory, in the unitary gauge, one finds the action takes precisely this form, where the first one is a usual Maxwell-like term, and second one is just a mu square, and it's multiplied by this spatially varying mass gap, or this, the expectation value of scalar field square. And that can be always purely decomposed, and as one can see from the definition of the Moyar-Starr product, this one basically induces, when multiplied by e to the ipx, the shift of a mu over x from one point to another. So this is kind of non-local, the mass term. But this is precisely the low-energy effective Lagrangian of this non-commutative U1 gauge when it's coupled to adjoint scalar and in the spontaneous broken phase. So that's basically what I want to say, I'd like to get the questions.
Questions?
Two or three related questions, please. Firstly, in the 2+1 dimensional case, could you say again why you're allowed to choose different Fermi levels in the two wells?
Uh-huh.
Secondly, since there are an infinite number of eigenvalues, why don't the fermions spill over? Why don't they go to infinite height?
Okay, so remember that even though we have a regularized infrared, essentially we have to take the infrared cutoff removed to get the non-commutative plane. So that corresponds in the corresponding matrix model languages, n taking to infinity. So in that limit, this the eigenvalue tunneling from one to the other is suppressed. Therefore, this is leading order WKB of the result, and that's the reason why I am allowed to take the integration constant e to be unequal from one to the other wall.
Okay. Would the minimum energy solution have the two integration constants being the same in the case where it's a double well?
No, because they are not communicating at all, I can just take the patchwise differential. For example, I can also even consider the wall, the potential here is diverging to infinity, and from non-commutative field theory point of view, they don't really see whether in the middle, which is classically forbidden region, is spiking up to infinity or just a finite barrier here. On the other hand, if I take just the non-commutative tori, then it's essentially just a quantum mechanical problem. So even though you just take continuum limit, the eigenvalues always tunnel with each other, and that's not surprising because that's a quantum mechanical system.
Sorry, one more question, please. Yeah. Since there are an infinite number of eigenvalues, why doesn't the well fill up? Why do you stop at finite?
Okay. Here, of course, I mean, one can also imagine taking very fine-tuning of the potential coupling parameter. So, but I'm not taking any double scaling limit. For generic quadratic, inverse quadratic one here, which is generic behavior, the energy levels always pile up, which is also a well-known fact. So even if I have infinite many fermions, they never speed up classically.
It's precisely about this picture with two levels, my question. In a recent paper of François David and Bertrand Hinard, it was pointed out actually that this tunneling between two wells is important even on the tree level if you do, for example, the calculation of correlators of eigenvalues. This tunneling still occurs, and the reason is that you have a very high degeneracy. In principle, you have to sum up over close. You should take into account not only the situation when E1 is equal to E2, but close situations when the levels are a little bit different. And it has a very high degeneracy. And in fact, the effects of tunneling survive even in the large N approximation. So my question is whether it could alter somehow.
Okay, so
your picture.
I'd like to talk about that. Okay.
Any other question? Well, if there are no other questions, let's thank the speaker once again. The next speaker is Professor Satashvili.